What is the MMCD? Well, as I said, it was called the Master Municipal Construction Documents. Master because we originally hoped, and it's proven out that way, that this would become the standard for British Columbia. Municipal because it is for municipal infrastructure, and it's for the construction of that. We've created an integrated set of documents which form the skeleton of a tender package and the contract that goes with a construction project. Each municipality or consultant working for municipality have to then take this skeleton and fill it out for a particular project to add all of the unique details that make that project what it's intended to be. And so it's a very niche market document. It's designed specifically for municipal infrastructure, and only a subset of that. It's only designed for the infrastructure that's basically below ground and up to street level for roads and sewers, a little bit of parking, street lighting, traffic control. It's really not for above ground construction. We don't have the specifications in our book for the broad range of topics that are involved in, say, creating a new rec center or municipal hall. So what it is a niche document, but it's very good at what it does. It's also for unit price contracts. And by this I mean that the majority of the items that a contractor is going to bid on will be per each, or per lineal meter, or per square meter, or per ton. Sure, there'll be some lump sum items in it, but the intention is not to have a lump sum contract. This document is designed with a particular balancing of the risk between the owner and the contractor, which is suitable for a unit price contract. And finally, it's designed for the BC legal environment. It refers to BC laws for things like builder's lien and workers' compensation. And it would need to be modified if you're working in a different legal environment. For instance, if you're working for DNIA or in Alberta or the Yukon or whatever. Some consultants have managed to do that successfully, but at this point the association does not have standard documents for those other jurisdictions. So, in short, this is a good document to use when BC law applies, when you need municipal works which are underground to street level or involve street lighting, traffic control, maybe a little bit of park stuff, and where unit prices form the majority of the items that a contractor will bid on. Don't use the documents if your need is to have a lump sum or fixed price contract. If your need is to build something with structural components above ground, unless you want to add all the necessary specifications to do that. There's nothing wrong with what we've got here. It's just not sufficient. And it's not sufficient for jobs where you anticipate hazardous material cleanup. And I'll talk a little bit about that when we get to how we deal with risk on hazardous materials. So here's a couple of slides of classic work that's suitable for MMCD. Urban or rural municipal infrastructure, below ground, dealing with utility services, absolutely classic for our type of thing. Streets, curbs, sidewalks, paving, all of that, again, is classic. So how do we get started? Well, in 1988, owners and consultants and contractors realized that there was a better way to do things, and part of that would be to try for some standardization. And so initially the first project was to standardize product specifications. And as a gravel supplier, I was just delighted to see that we were finally getting to standard specifications for things like three-quarter road base, which every municipality seemed to have a slightly different specification. Now there's basically two specs in the province. There's the Ministry of Highway spec, and there's the MMCD spec. And that sure makes it a lot easier for contractors and suppliers, and it brings the cost down for owners. After the specifications were done, the same committee, called the Joint Municipal Committee at that point, then moved on to develop the standard detail drawings. They took the standard detail drawings from Surrey and, with Surrey's blessing, modified them into the standard, which is, with minor modifications, published in our document today. Those two projects went fairly well, and so the Joint Municipal Committee decided, well, let's move on and see if we can't come up with something to standardize the contract language, the rules of the game, because there were so many problems from having bad language, and actually quite a few problems where contractors would forget which municipality they were dealing with, and they would refer to contract documents for some other municipality where they'd worked recently. So there was a lot of benefit to standardizing the contract language amongst the municipalities. So we, by 1995, we had published the first book, the Red Book, and it included the new contract language, the front-end documents for creating a tender, such as the instructions to tenders and the form of agreement, form of contract. It included the general conditions and the work of the other two committees on the standard detail drawings and the standard specifications. This book, as I said, was called the Red Book. It was updated to the Gold Book in 2000, and it was updated to the current Platinum Edition in 2010, or 2009. We create updates to these documents continuously. We publish the updates on our website for owners to download and use as they see fit. But they don't become part of a contract until owners actually incorporate them into the language or the contract documents that they publish. However, once we publish them on our website, you can be certain that they will appear in the next published document and become part of the standard. So, for instance, all of the changes that happened between 2000 and 2008 were incorporated into the new Platinum Edition when it was published in 2009. So you can go onto our MMCD website at any point and see what new changes are coming down the stream. So the reason this project got three-party support was that all parties could see they had some benefits, that it minimized efforts and errors in both preparing tender documents and responding to tender calls. It minimized confusion in standards and contract terms between municipalities, so everybody was more or less using the same standards. It reduced construction and administration costs because we now had standard specifications, we now had standard products, and we now had standard requirements, rights and responsibilities that people were more likely to remember and understand. In addition, owners got a couple of additional benefits that focused on them. Having a standard document improve the credibility should they need to defend themselves in disputes in court. And more importantly, somebody else was doing the updating for them. We'd estimated that by 1995, when we published the first edition, that if we'd had to pay for all the volunteer time and as well as the consultants, we would have spent about $500,000 to develop these documents. And seeing as we've updated them twice since then, I'm guessing that it would be well over $1 million worth of effort into these documents so far, which is a sum that most municipalities would not even consider to create and maintain a set of documents for their own use. So they get the benefit of having somebody else keep these documents current, both technically and legally. So today, the coalition members bring those same three perspectives to the association. The Municipal Engineers Division of the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of BC represent the owners. The BC Road Builders and Heavy Construction Association represents contractors, and the Consulting Engineers of BC represent the consultants who work for municipalities in this regard. We've got other financial supporters, over 40 municipalities throughout BC, plus the GVRD. And we also have two ministries of government that are in eager supporters. The BC Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure, and whatever the BC Ministry of Municipal Affairs is called this week. I can't keep up with the name changes on them, but they both have representatives on our board. So I don't know if you in the room can read that very well. Those of you with slides can zoom in on them. But it's really just to show you that our board still reflects the input of the various parties. There's the Ministry of Community Development, Ministry of Transportation, the Municipal Engineers Division, the Road Builders, Consulting Engineers, and there are some appointed directors as well, which I'm one. The organization itself has an executive committee, an education committee, a marketing committee, documents committee, referee committee, and specific task forces to do projects. Our perspective today, we'll just talk about the Documents Committee. The Documents Committee has overriding control for the language of the contracts, but they also have oversight on two subcommittees, a Civil Committee and Electrical Subcommittee. These two bring their technical expertise to the changes in the in the specifications, so that the electrical committee, for instance, will develop changes to the electrical specs with input from their advisors, and they have a group of people, again, trying to represent all three perspectives on their committee. They have a transportation subcommittee. The Civil Committee has some subcommittees as well, and they funnel their recommended changes up to the Civil Committee for approval. The Civil Committee, like the Electrical Committee, will then refer their proposed changes to the Documents Committee for final review, where we just do a check to make sure that the language is consistent, the format is consistent. We don't get into the technical details. That's what their mandate is. We just make sure that they follow the same philosophies and use the same language and numbering systems and that kind of stuff, so that when we issue the changes, everything is in sync with our standards. And then the Civil Committee will make their recommendations, and the board will make final approval of the changes as they are published to the website for inclusion in other documents. So how do we measure our success? Well, since we got started, we now have over 90 municipalities buying the MMCD. We don't really have a good measure of what level of use each municipality makes of them, but we know that they are at least in some level of use at the various municipalities. We're recommended by those two government ministries. The Ministry of Municipal Affairs recommends that municipalities use these when they make grant applications, because then the provincial government knows they're getting a project that's built to a realistic standard without excessive bells and whistles. The Ministry of Transportation and Highways recommend that municipalities or have accepted the MMCD standards for those intersections where a municipal road will intersect a BC highway. Users themselves have reported up to a 10% savings in cost when they switched over to the MMCD through the benefits of standardization and not having to update their contracts all the time. And users recommend the contract to non-users. But the most objective measure that I think we can have to show how successful this has been is that in the 14 construction seasons since the Red Book came out, there has been no MMCD contracts that had to go to court for litigation where the issue was between the contractor and the owner. There was one in the Okanagan which dealt with an insurer, contractor's insurance company, and the municipality, and they happened to be using an MMCD contract. But in terms of disputes between an owner and a contractor, these documents seem to keep people out of court. And that's a tremendous benefit to all parties and very significantly different from the time before the MMCD was in place. So we're successful because we develop language through consensus. At the committee level, I can tell you there have been some very heated debates about some changes, and we never finalize something just because one party says that's the way it's got to be. We keep working on it until all parties say, well, it's not really what I wanted, but I can live with it. And with that consensus, we can go forward knowing that we've got a pretty well-balanced document. Secondly, the document was created intentionally with a mandate for fairness and with protection for both parties and to deal with things that couldn't be foreseen at the time the contract was signed. And finally, we think the third key element is that the documents are fairly easy to read and understand. In most cases, the clauses are pretty readable. There's a couple where the lawyers and the insurance people still got their hooks in, but by and large, we did not a bad job. So the three perspectives give us a much better document than just having one group, typically the owner, say what the contract is going to be. We got this document through the volunteer efforts of members from all three perspectives. We created the structure, we agreed on the concepts that would be embodied, and then we had the language drafted by experts, either consultants or lawyers, and then we vetted it to make sure that it met the test of fairness, that it met the test of readability. And finally, we had our early draft reviewed by experts in the three fields, the owners, the contractors, and the consultants, and by a retired Supreme Court judge. And we asked them, give us your feedback. Are we straying too far afield? And they all said, this is a great document, a big improvement. They all made some minor suggestions, which we incorporated. But by and large, we got their unqualified approval on what we were doing. And it has proven so today to be a very successful document. So here were the philosophies that embodied the, or were given to the committee when they were told to go away and come back with a set of contract documents. Be fair to all parties. we realized that many of the problems that owners had had in the past, many of the things that took them to court, was they started off with unfair documents that had very serious biases and attempted to transfer risk where risk wasn't manageable by the contractor. Provide a fair way to resolve disputes. This is the second big thing that leads people into court. If they can't resolve the disputes themselves, then they resort to court. So we ended up trying to, we started out by saying we're going to have disputes. We can't write a contract that somewhere down the road isn't going to cause a problem for somebody. So recognize that there are going to be disputes. How will we handle that? And how will we maximize the chances that the parties will be able to resolve it themselves? The next thing was, we realized we didn't have a perfect crystal ball. And so we would never be able to understand or anticipate all the ways that this document might get used. And so because of that, we said, we've got to make sure there's a fair way to address changes. The next one was a little more controversial. The mandate was reduce risk-taking by the contractor. Well, this was a complete turnabout to previous documents where owners tried to shift all of the risk to contractors. But it never worked. And so we started with the premise that the owner owns all of the risk before they tender. And the process of tendering involves deciding how much risk you're going to sell to the contractor. And the contractor decides when they bid what they're going to pay or what they're willing to accept to take that risk. And so as we go through this presentation, I'll point out to you some areas where we've specifically limited the contractor's risk on the basis that if the owner shifts too much to the contractor, then they pay too much in the long run because some of the time that risk doesn't happen and the contractor just gets to pocket it. And even if the risk does happen, the contractor's got a margin in there, hopefully with a profit on it, that the owner's paying for. So there are times when it makes sense for an owner to try and transfer the majority of the risk. And there's times, and we say in the underground infrastructure field, where most of the time it does not. The next one was, let's make sure it's written in plain English. We don't want people to in the field to have to refer back to the vice president or the company's lawyer or the municipality's solicitor to understand what a party is supposed to do in a given circumstance. And finally, avoid repetition. This was an unusual mandate to be given. But the concept was, if you say something twice in a document, you will undoubtedly say it slightly differently. And that opens the door to problems. So we have attempted to create a document where, by and large, we only say things once, and then we refer to that definition. And we'll look at how we do that. And that was specifically with the intention of attempting to reduce the chances of creating problems and claims. There were a few other principles that we developed as we went through. No surprises. Those of you that have been in the construction industry for any length of time will know that when you get a phone call and the guy on the other end says, hey, I got a surprise for you, it's generally not a real good one. From my own experience, I'll tell you the worst one I had. I got a call one morning at 2 or 3 in the morning, and phone rings, and I sort of wake up partly and answer it. The fellow says, are you the guy that's in charge of that dredge that's tied up down by number 5 road on the Fraser River? I said, yeah, I think I am. And he said, well, it's sinking. So, 3 o'clock in the morning call, you get a surprise. Not fun. we took that policy and we incorporated it into our language. And we said, surprises are not good. They're going to happen, but the sooner we can bring them out in the open, the better we are able to deal with them, and therefore we're going to get a better solution and probably a lower cost solution. The next principle that we incorporated into the documents was that the CA signature is good as gold. What does that mean? That means that the owner is contractually obligated to give responsibility to a person called the contract administrator, who I've abbreviated throughout this as CA. That contract administrator thus represents the owner for almost everything in the contract. And when that contract administrator signs a document, be it a field memo, a change order, a certificate of payment, a certificate of substantial or total performance, or any other document, it cannot be overridden by someone else in the owner's organization, because that was the responsibility that was delegated to this person. And the contractor then does not have to worry about whether the CA has the authority to sign it. Once the contractor has a document with the CA signature on it, that contractor can rely on it. That's good as gold. It's up to the CA to know when they have the authority to sign that document on their own, or whether they have to go back into their organizations to get additional approvals before they sign it. But that's not the contractor's problem. We also provide incentives to do things right and sanctions when things are done wrong. So it's a carrot and a stick principle that we apply in a number of cases, and I'll show you some examples when we look at specific language. We've tried to use consistent terminology, again, to minimize confusion. We've avoided the something-for-nothing syndrome. We understand that contractors don't intend to be charitable organizations, and they expect to get paid and make a margin on the work they do. The offset to that is the owner's expecting to get a competent contractor, that there are some standards that have to be met. And we'll talk about how we give the owner the ability to look into that and to make some changes if they're not getting competency. We believe that appropriate administration and communication is key to a smooth running job. So we've set some deadlines for processing paperwork, for issuing notices of claims or disputes. And we've created a structure to promote prompt dispute resolution rather than leaving things to the end of the job. There's some consequences to this this type of approach. Owners have to accept the fairness principle. They have to understand that in a, particularly in a fairly remote community or a small community, the owner's going to be there for a long time. The municipality's going to be there a long time. The contractors may be there for quite a long time. And what goes around comes around. And so we're working all the time to improve the ability of owners and contractors to get along, because working together as a team is going to give a much better result than if people start off with bad blood from past jobs. I mentioned before that there is a requirement for competency, and that we expect all parties to bring competent players to the game. Part of that is an understanding of what are the rules and how to follow them. Part of them is to have the ability to resolve disputes early and to deal with them before they fester and become major impediments to working relationships and therefore the progress of the job. The say-it-once principle has a lot of benefits, but one of its downsides is that if you're not careful when you edit the documents, you can take out stuff that's critical, or you can put in things that have ramifications that you might not have anticipated. One of the really nice benefits of the new Platinum Edition is that it's also available as an electronic document. You can buy it as a printed version, or you can buy it as a secure PDF file. And the PDF file gives you the ability to do word searches. So if you're looking to edit the document, it's really nice to be able to find all the occurrences of the word that you're concerned about. Or if you're writing a change order or a field memo, it's really nice to be able to look and see all the occurrences of the topic that you're intending to write about. Or if you're presenting a claim, to be able to quote the sections that you're relying on. So the new electronic document, I think, is going to become more and more popular as more people start using these tablets in the field and see the benefits of having an electronic version right at hand. Now, I mentioned before that one of the key elements of the MMCD is proper risk management. We said it's not in the owner's interest to attempt to sell all of the risk all the time, because in the long run, the owner pays too much. Secondly, if you know of risks, you must disclose them. That came out of a BC court case back in the 60s, I think, when the PGE tried to hide geotechnical conditions when they were tendering for the Dease Lake extension. And the contractor basically went broke, but took the PGE to court, and the judge said, that's civil fraud. You can't hide circumstances or conditions which would affect the bidder's choice of the pricing they're going to put in. So it's a legal requirement to make sure that you've revealed everything you know about the job. And we'll talk a little bit later about how we help to clarify that. So the printed document, the document that contains the pink pages, sets out the baseline risk that the owners and contractors agree on. And if owners want contractors to take more risk than that, they have to write supplemental conditions or supplemental specifications or issue supplemental drawings. And it's those supplemental documents that are the flags for the contractors to look and see how has the risk allocation shifted. And by making the bound document part of the contract, contractors don't have to read this every time. They look at the supplementals to see what's different. And that should help reduce the time and effort it takes to bid jobs. I said before that we started with the premise the owner owns all the risk before you tender. So the owner has the ability to choose how much risk evaluation to do in advance. Do they want to do more geotechnical studies to reduce the risk of the unknown? They weigh off that cost with the cost of having to deal with those unknown circumstances as the job progresses. When tendering, the owner sells some of that risk to the contractor, and the owner can choose how much of that to do. It's up to the CA to ensure that that risk apportionment remains the way the owner intended throughout the contract, that the contractor doesn't get off the hook for risk the contractor purchased, and the owner doesn't end up taking back risk because the CA has gotten involved in telling the contractor how to do things.